It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headlines.
The WHO says the Ebola outbreak has now taken nearly 2,300 lives. Liberia's defense minister warns his country's existence is threatened by the virus. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The World Health Organization says the death toll from the West African Ebola outbreak has climbed to nearly 2,300, with more than 4,000 known cases. Nearly half of all deaths and cases have occurred in just the past 3 weeks. Nowhere is the disease more profoundly affecting society than Liberia, where about 60% of all fatalities and new cases have developed in 21 days. Karen Lundgren is the UN mission chief to Liberia. She addressed the UN Security Council Tuesday.
The Ministry of Health puts the number of reported cases above 2,070, with over 1,200 deaths. But these numbers understate Ebola's true toll. The speed and scale of the loss of lives and the economic, social, political, and security reverberations of the crisis are affecting Liberia profoundly.
A WHO report released Monday warned the number of new cases in Liberia is increasing exponentially and said thousands of new patients can be expected in coming weeks. WHO says 160 healthcare workers have become sick, 80 have died there. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf said she expects the crisis to worsen, calling it a grave situation. Her defense minister, Brownie Samukai, also addressed the Security Council.
We are meeting at a time when Liberia is facing a serious threat to national existence. The deadly Ebola virus has caused a disruption of the normal functioning of our state. The disease, which early this year was identified in the remote villages of our country, has now reached urban centers, including the capital, Monrovia.
The UN is to hold a high-level event September 24 to spur greater international attention to the global response to the Ebola epidemic. This is VOA News. Liberian officials say their country's response has been hampered by a lack of treatment and testing centers, few healthcare workers, and persistent fear of and ignorance about the deadly virus among the people. Mrs. Sirleaf said the international response is behind the need. VOA's Anne Lokin-Dakar reports on the lack of treatment centers in Liberia to deal with the Ebola epidemic.
Ebola treatment units in Monrovia are filled to overflowing. Each is only able to take in a trickle of new patients as beds become free. The Elwa 3 clinic, run by Doctors Without Borders, is the largest in Monrovia. They are in the process of expanding from 120 beds to 400 beds. Crews are working around the clock to get a new government-run treatment unit open later this week in Monrovia with 100 beds. But the World Health Organization says that's not enough. The caseload is exploding in Monserrato County, which contains the capital. The WHO says 1,000 beds are needed. Hundreds of health workers must also be trained to staff them. And look, VOA News. Dakar.
And the World Health Organization says intense transmission of Ebola continues in Guinea and Sierra Leone. In Nigeria, conflicting reports persist on the state of fighting between security forces and Islamist militants with the group Boko Haram. Nigerian forces, backed by warplanes Tuesday, reportedly battled militants around the village of Michika in Adamawa State, taken by the militants on Sunday. They're also reportedly attacking militants in Madagali, Baza, and Uba. The Associated Press quotes a Boko Haram spokesman, Abu Zanira, as denying government claims that security forces recaptured the city of Bama in Borno State, just not far from the state capital, Maiduguri. Meanwhile, the French press agency says 20 Nigerian policemen are still missing 3 weeks after Boko Haram fighters attacked their training academy outside the village of Gwaza in Borno State. The judge in the Oscar Pistorius murder trial is expected to render her verdict Thursday. Sekola Selo, a South African journalist and former colleague of Judge Thokozile Masipa, has been watching the case unfold.
She is not the sort of person to become emotive. I don't recall ever her making any emotive outbursts about anything, you know, even with her colleagues. So the manner in which she has, you know, conducted herself, I mean, I've been watching the case, like most South Africans, very closely. Again, you know, that level-headedness which she's displayed even when she was just a journalist, it is coming through.
Pistorius, a double amputee, a sprint runner, faces 25 years to life in prison if convicted of killing his girlfriend in February of last year. And police in Burundi Tuesday arrested a man suspected of raping and killing three elderly Italian nuns. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September the 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's Defense Minister Brownie Samukai says Ebola threatens his country's existence.
We are meeting at a time when Liberia is facing a serious threat to national existence. The deadly Ebola virus has caused a disruption of the normal functioning of our state.
Health leaders discuss new communication strategies for Ebola. A new study touts AIDS treatment success rates in South Africa. And the UN mission in South Sudan says it has evidence that its helicopter, which crashed last month, was shot down.
Whoever is responsible for the shoot down, first of all, we demand that those who are responsible be held accountable and be punished for this unprovoked and deadly attack.
Joel Contreras is spokesman for the UN mission in South Sudan. We'll examine Somalia's Go to School initiative. The OECD says access to education is growing and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere have reached a new level. Those stories plus Mark Omar's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's Defense Minister Brownie Samukai told the UN Security Council on Tuesday that the Ebola virus has become a health emergency for his country, surpassing his government's capacity to respond. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
Liberia is the hardest hit of the West African countries affected by the ongoing outbreak of the disease. 9 of the country's 15 counties are currently affected, and the Ministry of Health has put the number of reported cases above 2,000, with over 1,000 deaths. Liberia's Defense Minister Brownie Samukai told the Security Council that Ebola is affecting every sector of society.
We are meeting at a time when Liberia is facing a serious threat to national existence. The deadly Ebola virus has caused a disruption of the normal functioning of our state.
He said the government has taken emergency steps to limit the spread of the disease, including declaring a 90-day state of emergency, putting non-essential government employees on leave, quarantining severely affected communities, and imposing a nationwide curfew.
In spite of all of these measures, continuous denial, traditional practices, religious rituals, fear, and community resistance still constitute obstacles to progress.
Minister Samukai said the country lacks the infrastructure, logistical capacity, professional expertise, and financial resources to effectively combat Ebola, and he welcomed UN and international assistance. The top UN diplomat in Liberia, Karen Langren, said the spread of the disease has been merciless.
The speed and scale of the loss of lives and the economic, social, political, and security reverberations of the crisis are affecting Liberia profoundly.
Landgren warned that there is a potential for instability as the health system struggles, the economy suffers, food shortages spread, and political processes such as planned Senate elections for October become delayed. She said the country, which had the weakest health system in the region before the crisis, is overwhelmed with a shortage of medical workers and beds in treatment centers. At least 160 health workers have been infected and about 80 have died from the virus with its hemorrhagic fever-like symptoms. Langren said the UN mission in Liberia is focused completely on combating Ebola and offered significant logistical support to the government response. The United Nations says Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is planning to convene a high-level event on the sidelines of the General Assembly annual debate later this month to highlight the needs and required response to Ebola from the private and public sectors. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The importance of local efforts to spread new messages about Ebola were emphasized during a two-day forum that wrapped up Tuesday in Dakar. Christian Roby reports for VOA from Senegal's capital on how organizations are working with communities to fight the disease with messages of hope and love.
Health authorities from all over West Africa gathered in Dakar to figure out how to better communicate with people affected by Ebola. Their common message: local leaders need to be their allies. The conference was organized by the International Federation of the Red Cross. Its Africa Zone Director, Alassane Senghor, says he hopes organizations come together with a unified message that promotes life, not death.
See, people don't understand, they are bound to create problems for even those who are helping them.
He says the solution is to involve local communities more in outreach, to talk with people instead of at them. Health advisor for the Economic Community of West African States, Dr. Marion Ngola, says the effort needs a cooperative approach.
They are organized. They have their leaders. If we approach them in a way that we have something to share with you, how do we do it? They will tell us. They will listen. And we will change what needs to be changed.
Women account for more than half of Ebola deaths in this outbreak. Public health experts say early interventions did not focus enough on women. Now, subregional coordinator on Ebola for the UN Children's Emergency Relief Fund, Grev Hunt, says that is changing.
We're using women-to-women communication. In addition, we're developing materials for illiterate populations, and the preferred method is going door-to-door. One woman talking to another woman on how she can protect her loved ones. So she's using her heart and her hands to keep her loved ones safe.
However, the message must evolve with reality. In the early days of the outbreak, much of the communications work was focused on getting people to accept that Ebola is real and go seek treatment. Now, Hunt says, with treatment centers at capacity and many health workers refusing to come to work, this is not possible.
We're saying treat at home because there is not the capacity, there aren't enough beds in the treatment centers. It's morally difficult for us to say, but what we're teaching them is how to keep their hands protected, how to rehydrate the patient.
Organizers predict that with these changes outlined at this session, along with adopting phrases such as "Together we can stop Ebola" to promote unity, the Ebola mortality rate of this outbreak will decrease in the coming months. Kristen Roby for VOA News, Dakar.
A new medical study out of South Africa has found heartening news. In a nation with the world's highest burden of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, the findings revealed that South Africans with HIV can live as long as HIV patients in the United States, provided they begin antiretroviral therapy early enough. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to one of the head researchers and has this report.
HIV has cut a huge swath through South Africa. Today, the nation has between 5 and 6 million patients and the world's largest antiretroviral treatment program. Many AIDS activists say the disease's wild spread in the early 2000s was multiplied by the government's disastrous policy of denying the urgency of the epidemic and failing to offer adequate advice and treatment. But just a few short years after South Africa's government turned around its policy, there is a small ray of hope. Researchers from the University of Cape Town and other institutions have concluded that South Africans now on antiretroviral AIDS treatment fare as well as patients in developed nations after 2 years of treatment. Dr. Andrew Boole is with the University of Cape Town School of Public Health and Family Medicine.
What we found is that although in South Africa mortality is initially higher than it is in Europe and North America, as a result of people starting treatment with more advanced disease, once people have stabilized on treatment, typically about 2 years, the mortality in South Africa has fallen to levels at least comparable to North America.
For 4 years, the researchers followed the welfare of more than 30,000 HIV-positive adult patients in South Africa, comparing them to nearly 37,000 patients in North America and Europe. At first, the news was not encouraging. Because of many factors, including stigma and lack of resources, South African patients fared worse in the first year of treatment. That is because many had entered treatment at a later stage than their Western counterparts. But after 2 years, South Africans still on treatment rallied. One reason, Bull says, may be the social aspect of the disease. In Southern Africa, the disease covers a wide segment of the population. For example, South Africa's government estimates that nearly 16% of working-age people are infected. In developed nations, it still disproportionately affects already marginalized groups, like people who inject drugs, a group that is already less likely to get proper medical care and is prone to other ailments, which puts them at a disadvantage. Bull says that South Africa's massive treatment program also deserves credit for the turnaround. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
It is Wednesday morning, September the 10th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The UN mission in South Sudan says it now has evidence that a UN helicopter that crashed near Bentiu last month was shot down. Three Russian crew members were killed and a fourth seriously injured when the helicopter crashed near the United States Capitol on August 26. Joe Contreras, spokesman for the UN mission in South Sudan, says it is too early to apportion blame for the attack.
A more in-depth technical investigation is underway, and also the United Nations will set up an independent board of inquiry to look into the incident. And that additional information should make it possible to conclusively determine who fired on the helicopter that Tuesday.
Brad Onmi says that just over a week before the crash, its staff in Bentiu received a phone call from Peter Gadet, the commander of the opposition forces in Unity State, who said he believed Onmi's aircraft were being used to transport government forces. Gadet threatened to shoot down the mission's aircraft, Onmi says. SPLA spokesman Philip Aguirre said hours after the crash that Gadet's men had shot it down. Contreras says the investigation is ongoing.
Whoever is responsible for the shoot down, first of all, we demand that those who are responsible be held accountable and be punished for this unprovoked and deadly attack. And also we want to remind them that the peacekeeping mission, and for that matter, all United Nations agencies have full freedom of movement guaranteed to them, and they should respect our freedom of movement in South Sudan and also respect the inviolability of both our personnel and also our assets and facilities.
UNMISS is working with UN, South Sudanese, and Russian experts to investigate the attack on the helicopter. Contreras did not indicate how long the investigation is expected to last.
That was John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reporting from Washington. A year after the launch of the much-publicized Go to Schools initiative, the Somali government and the UN report that nearly 60,000 children have been enrolled into schools in Somalia during the past year. Authorities said almost 2,000 teachers were recruited and numerous schools reconstructed as part of the first phase of a three-year campaign to enroll 1 million children into schools. Linda Jones is head of UNICEF's education programs. She says shortcomings on funding and keeping up the momentum are the main challenges.
The Go to School initiative was launched by the government of Somalia in 2013, a year ago today. And it was a response for the urgent need for a massive expansion of education services to be achieved. The target is for 1 million children and youth who are currently out of school to be enrolled into education services.
How many children were enrolled so far into schools?
So far, in South Central, 40,000 children have been enrolled over the year into education. And South Central, of course, is where the enrollment figures have been the lowest.
But if this project is lasting for 3 years and you have only enrolled 40,000 for the first year, that means you're going to fall short of the target. Is that correct?
The first phase focused a lot on construction of schools and recruitment of teachers. 500,000 of the target are actually for youth education programs. So these youth education programs are currently not as funded as well as they should be. So there is a large need to accelerate those programs. Phase one is actually on target when it comes to the enrollment of children, and a lot of the construction is on target for South Central, and also the recruitment of teachers and payment of incentives for those teachers in the absence of salary is on target. But there is a need for a massive acceleration of the program in phase two and phase three.
And what are the challenges in terms of funding that you just raised?
What I can say is that there is good coordination amongst the partners, and there are a number of different funded programs which the ministry is leading on the coordination to ensure that the funding is well allocated. However, funding for youth education part of the Go to School is really lacking, and non-formal education, particularly targeting children in pastoralist communities, that needs to be accelerated and increased if the overall targets are going to be reached.
Linda Jones is head of UNICEF's education programs. She spoke from Nairobi, Kenya, with Harun Maruf of VOA Somali's service. A new report finds that access to education is growing worldwide, but the amount of higher education is deepening socioeconomic divides in many countries. The study, released on Tuesday by the Paris-based Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation, also finds that some emerging countries are making surprising strides. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from the French capital.
Well, the global financial crisis has dealt a blow to many nations. It has not slowed access to education. But according to the latest OECD Education at a Glance report, the quality and quantity of education is widening the divide between what it calls the haves and the have-nots. Those with lower education levels have been harder hit by rising unemployment, for example, and tend to earn significantly less than those with higher degrees. Across the 34 economically advanced countries of the OECD, unemployment rates for people with university education is about 5%, but it jumps to nearly 20% among 25 to 34-year-olds who do not have university degrees. OECD Education and Skills Director Andrea Schleicher says this trend can be seen in emerging nations as well.
In fact, that's one of the most surprising findings. You can see that in Brazil, you can see that in East Asia. I think for the countries where we do have data, it's a pretty common trend, and the recent financial crisis has amplified that trend. Education makes more of a difference in terms of your life chances than it used to do.
But the new study also finds education is flattening divides between some richer and emerging countries. Schleicher says nations like China, Vietnam, and Brazil are prioritizing education. They're investing scarce resources where it counts, in good teachers and principals, for example. They want to ensure that all their children get a decent education.
What's really interesting when you look at these data is that the world is no longer divided between rich and well-educated nations and poor and badly educated ones. Now, some of the middle-income countries see enormous progress.
The report finds that rates of education are expanding faster in many emerging economies than in their richer counterparts. The new study offers a snapshot of the educational systems of both OECD member states as well as those of nearly a dozen non-members, including China, India, Colombia, Brazil, and Russia. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The World Meteorological Organization says a surge in levels of carbon dioxide pushed the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to a record high last year. The UN agency warns continuing emissions of CO2 will have a huge impact on global warming. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the Greenhouse Gas Bulletin.
The World Meteorological Organization reports the rate of increase of CO2 in the atmosphere is the largest in 30 years. In addition, it notes two other important greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide, also are continuing to grow. WMO Secretary General Michel Jarraud says this is not good news. He notes CO2 accounts for 80% of the 34% increase in the warming of the atmosphere from 1990 to 2013. He says the increasing concentration of CO2 is a worrying signal.
The other thing which is worrying is that CO2 stays in the atmosphere for a very long period, hundreds of years. So even if we could stop the emissions tomorrow, what has been injected in the atmosphere, a significant fraction would stay in the atmosphere for a very long period, hundreds to thousands of years.
Jarraud says about 25% of what is emitted by human activity is absorbed by the ocean, another quarter by the biosphere, and the rest remains in the atmosphere. He warns past, present, and future CO2 emissions will have a cumulative impact on both global warming and ocean acidification. He tells VOA that time is not on our side. He warns the longer it takes to tackle this issue, the more challenging it will become.
Concentrations are reaching higher and higher value, and therefore it will require stronger and stronger action to avoid the climate changes to be so big that adaptation will be either more difficult, in some cases impossible, and in any case, more expensive.
Giraud says there's no doubt the climate is changing and weather is becoming more extreme due to human activities, such as the burning of fossil fuels. He says action is still possible, but it will take bold and courageous decisions on the part of nations. He says the world has the knowledge and the tools to keep temperature increases within 2 degrees centigrade. He says concerted international action must be taken for the sake of the planet and for that of future generations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. The wounded African champions Nigeria Super Eagles face their rejuvenated host South Africa in Cape Town today, Wednesday. Nigeria lost 3-2 to the Republic of Congo, while the new-look South African Bafana Bafana achieved a milestone with an unprecedented 3-0 triumph against Sudan in Khartoum. The rivalry at play in Cape Town is all the more intense as Bafana Bafana has yet to beat the Super Eagles in a competitive tie since South Africa's readmission into international sports in 1992. Meanwhile, Cape Verde Islands Blue Sharks host former African champions Zambia in their first international match at their new national stadium in Praia. The Blue Sharks are buoyant after their convincing triumph over their hosts Niger. Elsewhere, the seven-time Nations Cup winners, the Egyptian Pharaohs, welcome Tunisia in Cairo, aiming to get their campaign back on track after losing to Senegal in Dakar. Tunisia seek to consolidate their lead in the group following their weekend victory against Botswana. In Uganda, the 10-nation Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Associations, SECAFA, is rooting for Ethiopia, Sudan and Uganda to win against Malawi, the Republic of Congo and Guinea, respectively. SECAFA Vice President Lawrence Mulindwa said in Kampala on Tuesday that although Ethiopia and Sudan lost to Algeria and South Africa in their opening group ties, they can bounce back with victories away from home. He urged the Uganda Cranes to build on the momentum generated by their 1-1 draw with Ghana in Kumasi. The Cranes seek their first appearance in the Nations Cup since they were runners-up to hosts Ghana in 1978. Meanwhile, the Algerian Desert Fox have kept faith with their favorite hunting ground in Blida, where they host Mali. Blida, which is some 50 kilometers south of the capital, Algiers, offers Algerian fans fond memories of victories in crucial qualifiers for the 2010 and 2014 FIFA World Cups. Elsewhere, Cameroon host Ivory Coast in Yaoundé, Lesotho welcome Gabon in Maseru, Angola host Burkina Faso in Luanda, Togo play Ghana in Lome, Sierra Leone challenge the Democratic Republic of Congo in Lubumbashi, Mozambique play Niger in Maputo, and Botswana are at home to Senegal in Gaborone. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, September the 10th.
I wish to call on the federal government of Nigeria to listen to Nigerian Medical Association directives not to reopen schools for now. Surely there is no school in Nigeria with Ebola preventive kits. I wonder the rush to reopen school. School proprietors are after their pockets, not the welfare of parents or the safety of the school children. It's teaching time, says nine, and prevention is better than cure. Comrade Mazi Patrick Okoroka from Obligation Premises at an Arutuku in Abia State, Nigeria.
Thank you, listener, for your comment. And that's it for this Wednesday, September 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Barty in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC.
can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.